Okay, so imagine this. You're at home and you're trying to process this shock, right? Your husband just confessed to something huge.
Oh, wow.
He embezzled like a serious amount of money from his work.
No kidding.
And you're already dealing with, a recent miscarriage. Your world feels like it's falling apart.
Okay.
And then to top it all off, the insurance guy shows up at your door.
Oh, man. Talk about bad timing.
It sounds like, the beginning of some psychological thriller, right?
Probably.
But this is real. It's an actual legal case, Germantown Manufacturing Co. versus Rawlinson.
Right.
And it's got more drama than a lot of fictional stories I've heard.
Yeah, what makes this case really stand out, at least for me, is how it takes this, seemingly boring topic, contract law, and just throws it into this like pressure cooker of human vulnerability and all these ethical
We've
questions.
got court opinions, legal analyses, all that stuff to sort of guide us. And what we want to do for you today is really break down this whole situation. Like, why did the court end up siding with Joan Rawlinson,
Your wife?
right? Who was basically pressured into signing this agreement to cover her husband's debt.
Right.
What does all this tell us about contracts,
Yeah.
consent, and how the law tries to, handle these messy real-life situations?
Yeah, this case really puts a spotlight on those gray areas,
Right.
like, where the legal stuff meets like how people actually behave.
Okay, so to get started, let's rewind a bit, set the stage.
Okay.
So Robert Rawlinson, the husband in this case, he worked as the assistant controller at Germantown Manufacturing. And over a couple of years, he embezzled, get this, over $327,000.
Whoa, that's not small change.
No, not at all. But what's really important here is how this impacted his wife, Joan.
Right.
She becomes like the central figure in this whole legal battle.
Yeah, she's the one who ends up having to deal with the consequences.
Now, obviously, the company wanted their money back. And I mean, who can blame them? But the way they went about it, well, let's just say their methods are definitely debatable.
Yeah, I can see that.
So here's where Mr. Kolaski comes in, the insurance representative.
Okay.
Now, this guy, he was tasked with getting back the embezzled funds. And his interaction with Joan, that's really key to understanding why the court ruled the way they did.
I see. So his actions had a direct impact on the case.
Oh, absolutely. It's
Yeah.
a classic example of how, someone's actions, even little things, can have huge legal consequences.
Makes sense.
He shows up at their home, right,
Yeah.
saying he's there to discuss documents. But he didn't exactly lay everything out for John, who's already, incredibly vulnerable.
Oh, wow.
Emotionally, I mean.
Yeah, I bet.
So this is where, the concept of undue influence comes into play. The court, they really considered how emotionally vulnerable Joan was and the whole, the circumstances surrounding her signing these documents.
Right.
Which brings up a bigger legal question. Like, can you really say someone consented if they were under that much pressure?
Yeah, that's a tough one.
And to make things even worse, this wasn't your typical lawsuit.
Oh.
They wanted Joan to sign what's called a confessed judgment note.
Uh-huh.
So, can you explain that a little? What makes it different from a regular lawsuit? And why could it be, well, so problematic?
Sure, yeah. Think of a confessed judgment note like a legal shortcut.
Okay.
It lets the creditor, the person who's owed money, get a judgment against the debtor, the person who owes money, without all the usual court stuff.
Got it.
It's like skipping the whole trial and going straight to the verdict.
Wow.
Yeah, it gives the creditor a lot of power. And if it's used the wrong way, it can really leave the debtor with very few options.
So you got Joan dealing with everything her husband's done, her own emotional turmoil, and then she's suddenly hit with all these complicated legal documents. It's a lot to handle.
It's overwhelming for anyone, really.
Exactly. And she's not a lawyer. She shouldn't be expected to understand all those legal details, especially not in a situation like that.
No, not at all.
She tries to read through it all, but she's understandably overwhelmed and distraught. And let's be honest, how many of us actually read every single word of every contract we sign, especially when we feel pressured or, vulnerable?
That's a good point. I mean, I'm sure most people just skim over the fine print.
Right. This case really makes you think about our own habits with contracts. Like, do we just blindly trust? Do we really understand what we're signing up for?
It's something we should all think about more carefully.
Even those everyday agreements, they can have big consequences. And here's
Absolutely.
where things get really interesting. The court actually accepted three key defenses that let Joan get out of this judgment: fraud, duress, and unconscionability.
Wow, okay.
Let's break those down one by one.
Sounds good.
These defenses, they're like the foundation of the court's decision, and they each look at a different part of the agreement.
I see.
So did Joan actually consent? Was the contract itself fundamentally unfair?
Right.
The court looked at both Mr. Kolaski's actions and the power imbalance between him and Joan.
Interesting. So they took into account the context of the situation.
Exactly. So first up, fraud. It seems like Mr. Kolaski, he kind of downplayed how serious these documents were.
Okay.
He implied that they had enough assets to cover the debt, making it sound like, you know, a simple open and shut case.
Hmm. I see where this is going.
Right. And that's where material misrepresentation comes into play.
Right.
Even if Mr. Kolaski didn't lie outright, the court said his statements created a false impression.
Oh, so it's about the effect of his words, not necessarily his intent.
Exactly. They misled Joan into signing something she might not have otherwise agreed to.
Yeah.
Intention to deceive, it's not the point here. The impact is what matters.
That makes sense.
But there's another layer to this too, right? There's this unspoken but very real threat looming over Joan.
What do you mean?
It's like cooperate, or your husband faces prosecution.
Oh, wow. That's heavy.
Right. And that's the core of the duress argument.
Yeah.
The court recognized that the threat of criminal action against her husband, especially given her emotional state, was enough to negate her consent.
Mm-hmm.
She was basically cornered. Like she had no real choice.
Yeah, talk about pressure.
It's like they were holding her emotional well-being hostage. And then we get at the final defense, unconscionability. This one is especially interesting because it tackles the contract itself.
Okay.
The court basically said, these terms are so unfair, they can't stand.
Wow. So they actually nullified the contract.
Yeah, they did. So with unconscionability, the court focused on two specific things, unfair surprise and adhesive contract.
Okay, I'm following.
So for Joan, unfair surprise meant the terms of that second note, especially how open-ended it was, were completely unexpected. It wasn't something she had a real chance to understand.
Right.
It's like, you know those endless terms and conditions we scroll past online?
Yeah, those things nobody reads.
Right. But with way higher stakes.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then adhesive contract. Mm-hmm. That refers to how little bargaining power Joan had.
Okay.
Even if she had understood every detail, she couldn't negotiate. It was a take it or leave it situation. And leaving it, that meant her husband could face, you know, some really bad consequences.
Oh, man. She was stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Exactly. And this idea of an adhesive contract, this applies to tons of everyday contracts. Think about those long pre-written agreements you get when you sign up for a service or buy something.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
We hardly ever have any real negotiating power in those situations.
That's true.
So we've got misrepresentation, coercion, and a totally unfair contract.
Mm.
It's become pretty clear why the court ruled in Joan's favor.
Yeah, definitely.
But there's one more piece to this puzzle. It has to do with, well, with how they decided on the final amount on that second note.
Okay, this is getting interesting. Tell me more.
I will, but first, let's bring in our expert to explain a bit about good faith in contracts.
Yeah.
What do you say?
Sounds good to me. So remember that second note Joan signed? The one for, like, any amount over the initial note?
Yeah, the one where the exact amount wasn't clear until later, right?
Exactly. It was basically like signing a blank check.
Yeah.
And just hoping, right, that the person filling it out would be, well, fair about it.
Right, but hope doesn't really hold up in court. Did they stick to the actual amount that was embezzled?
Well, that's where things get even more more complicated.
Okay.
The president of Germantown, he later adds in an affidavit, and he tacks on, get this, over $45,000 in interest on top of the original amount.
Hold on. So they were adding on extra
yeah.
charges, even though that first judgment note had already been satisfied.
Yeah.
That seems incredibly unfair.
Yeah.
Especially considering everything, all the pressure she was under when she signed in the first place.
Exactly. And that's where this idea of good faith comes in. Every contract, even one involving a confessed judgment, there's this like built-in expectation of fairness and honesty.
So even though Robert Rawlinson did commit a crime, the court was saying Germantown couldn't just like throw ethics out the window and take advantage of the situation.
Right. They were drawing a line. You can't just abandon those principles, fairness, good faith, just because you're dealing with someone who messed up.
Yeah. It's a powerful reminder that justice, it's not just about punishing the wrongdoer. It's also about making sure that agreements are made and enforced ethically.
Yeah.
Even when one side has a legitimate grievance, it's about holding everyone to a certain standard.
Absolutely. It's about balance. Holding people accountable, yeah, but also protecting against exploitation, upholding those core principles of fairness.
Okay, so before we move on, I want to go back to confessed judgment for a sec.
Yeah.
You said earlier it gives the creditor a lot of power, which is why it has to be used responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
And this case really shows why. These confessed judgment notes, they shouldn't be a weapon to exploit someone who's vulnerable. They should be used carefully and ethically. It's almost like giving someone a loaded gun and hoping they'll use it responsibly. The potential for abuse, it's right there.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. In this case, with everything going on, it really highlights the importance of having legal representation.
You mean having a lawyer there to help you through the process?
Exactly. If Joan had had a lawyer during that meeting with Mr. Kolaski, things might have gone very differently.
How so?
A lawyer could have explained the terms, clearly, advised her about her rights, maybe even negotiated some better conditions.
Makes you wonder how often people waive their right to an attorney without really understanding what that means, especially when they're under pressure or dealing with a complex legal situation.
Yeah, it happens more than you'd think. This case is like a wake-up call, It shows how important it is to have legal advice, especially in high-stakes situations or when things are emotionally charged.
Okay, let's shift gears a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's revisit unconscionability. You mentioned unfair surprise and adhesive contract. Ooh. Can you give us some examples of how those concepts show up in real life? Outside of this case, I mean.
Sure. Think about contracts with predatory loan terms.
Okay.
Where the interest rates are crazy high, or there are all these hidden fees buried in the fine print. That's unfair surprise happening right there. Or employment contracts with clauses that really limit an employee's rights or their future job options.
So it's not just about confusing legal language. It's about, the power dynamic being off.
Yeah.
And the potential for one side to, to use unfair or unexpected terms to take advantage of the other side.
Right, exactly. It's about making sure there's a baseline level of fairness in these agreements. Doesn't matter what industry or context.
It's good to know the law provides some protection against those kinds of practices. But it also makes you realize we've got to be informed. We have to read the terms of any agreement before we sign.
Definitely. Knowledge is power, especially when it comes to legal stuff.
Now, I know we've talked a lot about the defenses and the accounting issue, but before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I want to touch on one more thing the court said. It was a really striking analogy they used to describe, what it means to sign a warrant of attorney.
You mean the warrior discarding his shield and sword?
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you break that down for us? What were they trying to say with that image?
They were emphasizing how vulnerable you become when you sign a confessed judgment note. You're basically giving up your legal defenses. It's a decision that shouldn't be taken lightly.
Right.
Imagine a warrior going into battle with no protection, totally at the mercy of their opponent. That's the level of risk you're taking when you sign a warrant of attorney without understanding what it means.
That's a powerful image. It really underscores the point that we should never sign anything without understanding the consequences, especially when it comes to legal documents.
Exactly. And that leads us to a really important point in our discussion. We've seen how Joan was pressured into signing an unfair contract. But this raises a bigger question. It goes beyond this case.
Okay, I'm listening.
It gets to the heart of our legal system, the nature of consent.
All right. I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
So in a world, right, where we've got all these complicated legal documents and fine print and power imbalances.
Right.
How do we even make sure that consent is truly informed and freely given? What can we do to protect people from getting into agreements that could really hurt them?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. This case, it makes you think about what consent really means, especially when it comes to legal stuff.
Right.
It's not enough to just have someone sign their name.
No.
We need to know they actually understood, agreed, and weren't forced or pressured into it.
Exactly. It's there's a difference between saying yes because you genuinely mean it and saying yes because you feel like you have to.
Right. Like you're intimidated or you don't get what you're getting into.
This case, it shows how important it is to be transparent and communicate clearly in these legal agreements.
Mm-hmm.
People need to know what they're agreeing to, and they shouldn't be tricked or pressured into anything that could hurt them.
Makes you wonder how many people have signed contracts without really understanding. you know? Maybe because they were scared or pressured or just didn't want to rock the boat.
It's a scary thought, and it shows why we need more awareness. People need to know their rights, their legal rights, and responsibilities.
So what can people do to protect themselves? Like, how can we make sure our consent is real and informed and freely given?
Well, the first thing, it might sound obvious, but never sign anything you don't fully understand.
Okay. Yeah.
That's key. If you see legal jargon you don't get or the terms aren't clear, get legal advice. It's worth it.
Better safe than sorry, right? Especially with legal stuff.
Absolutely. And don't be afraid to ask questions. If something seems off or unfair, speak up. You have a right to know what you're agreeing to and to try to negotiate terms that are, you know, fair and make sense.
Yeah. It reminds us that we all have a voice.
Yeah.
And we should use it.
Yeah.
Especially when our rights are on the line.
Exactly. And watch out for pressure tactics. If someone is rushing you or making you uncomfortable, you know, pushing you to sign, take a step back. Take your time. Think about your options.
Mm-hmm.
And get advice if you need it. Your signature, it's your word, and it has legal weight. Don't let anyone bully you into something you don't want.
Don't let anyone bully you into anything you're not okay with.
Right. And pay attention to the power dynamic. If you're dealing with someone who has way more power or resources, be extra careful.
Okay.
Don't be afraid to walk away from a deal that feels wrong, even if it means getting a lawyer to help you figure things out.
It's like, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Exactly. Trust your gut. If something feels off, it probably is.
So we've covered a lot today. From all the specifics of Germantown Manufacturing Company v. Rawlinson to the bigger picture of consent in contracts, what are some like key takeaways our listeners should remember as they deal with the legal world?
I think the most important takeaway is knowledge is power.
Okay, yeah.
The more we know about our rights and what we're responsible for, the better we can protect ourselves and make good decisions. This case is a perfect example, you know? Even those everyday agreements, they can have huge consequences, and we shouldn't take our legal rights for granted.
It also reminds us that the law, it's not just a bunch of, like, abstract rules. It's a way to make sure things are fair and just when we interact with others.
Right.
And sometimes, as we saw here, the law needs to step in to protect people from being taken advantage of or coerced, even when they've made mistakes or are going through tough times.
Yeah, this case really shows the human side of the law, how it deals with the messiness of real life and tries to be fair even when someone's done something wrong.
It's a good reminder that we all have a part to play in making sure the legal system does what it's supposed to do, protect the vulnerable and uphold justice and fairness.
And I want to leave our listeners with one last thought. This case, with everything that happened, it really shows the power of resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Joan Rawlinson, she went through something incredibly tough, but she stood up for her rights, and in the end, she won. It shows that even when things seem impossible, we can fight back. We can seek justice.
It's an inspiring story.
Yeah.
It shows that the law can be a tool for good, and that even when things are bad, justice can win out. This deep dive into Germantown Manufacturing Co. v. Rawlinson has taken us through the twists and turns of contract law, power dynamics, and the strength of the human spirit. Thanks for joining us. And remember, your rights matter, your voice matters, and you have the power to shape your own legal path.